I think it's fair to say, although I always rely upon writers to correct me, and I know that they will if I make a mistake along the way. But it's fair to say that Refuge is told with sections in the present time with the main character Cass, and much of the novel is her memories and remembrances of things past. In the present, she's on an island in a lake. And I make that reference simply because we are beside Lake Ontario, and if there's the occasional sound of a foghorn or a boat horn, we planned it, right?
Absolutely.
Because we want it to be authentic.
Entirely intentional.
14 years in the making? Is
yes.
that more or less correct?
Yes.
So that's a long journey. And clearly, I wouldn't burden you with telling the whole story of the book's beginning and its transformations, but maybe a short version of that 14-year journey.
Well, quite frankly, it surprised me to discover it was 14 years. When I was going through my notebooks, I was flipping back to find out when I actually started working on this book. And in my notebook for 2004 is the first page of this novel, almost entirely as it ends up in the book today. So it started with Cass, and it started with Cass McCallum, who's the protagonist in the book, and with her very strong 96-year-old voice. I've always loved older women. I've always had 90-year-olds in my life as I creep towards being an older woman myself. It's interesting because the older women have to get older and older. But I've always loved older women, and this voice came to me, and her story came out very slowly. And at first, I thought what I was going to do was tell the story of a woman birth to death so that we could know in literature something we almost never know in real life, which is a person for their entire life. Usually we know a slice of a person, you know, in the decade or two that we know them, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas and no other art form can do this, not dance, not movies. Only in literature can we know a person from beginning to end. And that fascinated me.
And know their thoughts.
I mean,
that's the other thing that literature does that other art forms can't.
That's right.
I mean, you know, when they try to do it in stage and in plays, they have to have somebody artificially stand there and, you know, do an aside as if what's going on through their
brain.
That's
right.
And but a writer can go into the mind anytime you
want.
And
even movies, all you can do is a voiceover, right? And you're overwhelmed by physicality in those other art forms, whereas in literature you have a page which can take you to the exterior or the interior with equal facility. So this is what I thought I was doing, and so I that's what I wrote. I wrote her story as it occurred to me. I don't know if she was telling me as it occurred to me. I had this brilliant idea that I would write every decade of her life in the style of the literature of that time. So, you know, I have a John Dos Passos chapter. I have a Gabriel Roy chapter. It was long and tedious to effect that. And I thought I was finished in 2008, and I presented it to my editor, and she said, "This is not a novel." It was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. I had scheduled some minor surgery, and I imagined myself lying on my couch, recovering, eating bonbons, and contemplating the six-figure offers. This did not happen.
You have an active fantasy life.
I do. Anyway, not only did Ellen Seligman reject it, and she was my editor at the time and really Canada's best known and I think best editor, but then my agent presented it to every other, publishing house in Canada, dozens and dozens of them, and everyone rejected it. So I knew that it wasn't personal. It was really something flawed in the text. I was devastated, and I spent a lot of time figuring out why I was devastated. And it was because not that I wanted to hold the book in my hand and not that I wanted any accolades that sometimes come with publishing a book. What I mourned was the loss of the conversation that ensues from the publication of a book. What I was grieving was not having the chance to talk about Cass with all those readers, not having a chance to talk about anything with readers. So my sons, in their wisdom, suggested I start a website, which I did. I also started a writer's festival. I also started a books column. So that all happened in the month after these rejections came in.
This is the old love affair breakdown. So get busy, yeah, get out there and
get out there and connect, right? Yes. So I was like speed dating, you know, in a literary sense, in a big, big way. So I started all these projects and they did distract me for a little while. But I could not forget Cass. People told me to put that novel away. It didn't work. It could not work. I was told by at least 5 different prominent editors that this idea was unworkable. So I put it away. I believed them. But I couldn't forget her. I mean, Cass was just such a strong character in my mind. And it wasn't until 2012 when I went to, when I started going to San Miguel in Mexico, and I was there with Margaret Atwood, and we sat down. We almost never talk writing, but I did present my dilemma to her of having this book that was, you know, putatively unworkable and yet unforgettable for me. And she said something wonderful. Which was, okay, imagine you're sitting, and you have to imagine Margaret Atwood saying this in her wonderful, ironic voice. Imagine you're sitting on a bus and this person sits down beside you and he opens a photo album and he says, oh, well, there's me in France and there's me in Italy and oh, there's me in Czechoslovakia. And by then you want to slit your wrists, right? Because it's absolutely boring. She said, you need an iron rod, a shish kebab to hang all those bits on. You know, if, for instance, somebody sat down beside you and said, oh, there's me in Paris, France. And 5 minutes after that picture was taken, a brick fell exactly in the place where I was standing. And there's me on the Bridge of Sighs in Venice. And 2 minutes after I moved away, a bus crashed over the, you know, I mean, it starts, you start to see patterns, you start to see relationships, and it becomes a story. And she was absolutely right. And it was another year before the kind of secret at the heart of Cass's life really started to blossom. I started to understand what was really at the heart of her. And then the character of Nang appeared. And then the
Nang
central...
Nang is the Burmese.
The Burmese young
refugee.
Woman, that's right, who comes to see her. And the meaning of her life came to me, which required a complete restructuring of the book. But the story itself didn't change at all.
I just want to go back to pick up on one thing when you said that all of these editors said the idea, I think I may be paraphrasing what you just said, but this idea won't work. And I'm wondering whether what they were identifying as a central issue was the same thing that Margaret Atwood was identifying as the central issue, or whether there were different perspectives of what wasn't working.
Well, I didn't understand what they said, and it was partly because of the way they were saying it, but I do think they were saying the same thing, that you can't tell a story from beginning to end, the story of a life, because there is no shape to it, right? A life evolves in all its different ways, and as I say at one point, I can't quote myself, but as Cass says at some point in the book, her life has had no shape. She's been floating in the waters of life and brushing up against various things that sort of push her
Big
in
things,
one direction
small
or another,
things.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's how I see like my own life is like that. It doesn't have an organizing principle other than the things that happen that seem random at the time and create a direction, you know. And so I think they were all saying the same thing, but not in a way that touched me. And what I found, which is, I mean, and many of their comments were quite specific. And I found that after I redrafted the book and I reread their comments, I had actually incorporated almost all of them without knowing it, because it had been, you know, 5 years since I'd read their comments.
And you never went back to them?
No, I never went back to them, but they were all right in their individual ways, but no one was able to articulate it in a way that made sense to me. Or maybe it took me, you know, maybe it took me those 4 years to distance myself enough from my original thought, which is tell a whole story and break down that notion enough that I was able to rethink it. It's very hard. Well, it's very hard to be a writer, of course, but it's very hard when you get a fix on an idea. It's hard to blast that open and see it from another perspective, because what you have with a story, you have a mass that is the story. It's like an ant walking around an apple, right? You get fixed in your one direction, but really that mass of material that is the story can be told from 1,000 different perspectives.
You know, I used to liken writers to God in the sense that, you laugh, but writers create worlds and through their imagination, but they people those worlds. But actually, now that just listening to you, I think that in some ways, if I've got my concept of God, or at least one concept, right, the writer's job is harder, because God just creates a bunch of things and lets them go and do whatever the heck they're going to do and doesn't interfere. That's free will. Just says, you know, okay, those are my creations. Whereas writers actually have to, I mean, you can't just create it. There is a structuring with infinite possibilities and variables. And so you're constantly making those choices. So we have two wonderful little bits that, teasers that we will get back to. Cass being one, obviously, because you clearly want to talk about Cass, so we will do that. The other is the structure of the novel, which I think is as ambitious a feat as I've seen, certainly in Canadian writing in maybe forever, really challenging. When you did go back to reorganize it, you took on a big job.
No kidding.
But I will leave those as teasers, so people will stick with us. And I'll move to actually, and we'll ease our way into that, because I want to talk about the acknowledgements. I'm the kind of reader that goes to, if there's an introduction, I love that. If there's a little preface, I love that. I go to the acknowledgements, you know, before I dip into the main meal. And the acknowledgements in this book are intriguing, tantalizing, mysterious.
Oh dear.
You've got, well, but you touch on sources, you touch on people, journals, and it's very clear. I know you've referred to yourself as a magpie, and it is very clear that you catch things and grab them, except that you do that, I think, not necessarily knowing when or where or how you're going to use them.
And I would actually say they catch me rather than me catching them, right? They're burrs that get caught on my clothes and I can't fully get them out.
So then my question is, and there is a question, talk a bit about the process of that, of them finding you, you being able to organize them in some way that they'll be useful at some point, and then the retrieval, because there must be a bank of stuff somehow. You must have an incredible filing. I don't know what you do, but...
No, you know, they're in my head. I don't write them down. I collect things.
Physical
things. So, I mean, some of the things that you're referring to are like my great aunt's scrapbook of medical oddities. You know, I have a real interest in medicine. I'm not sure why. It's partly that I come from a, you know, a landscape of nurses and pharmacists, and, you know, medical talk was always around me. And that really interests me a lot. I think it's partly because of the mind-body connection. I'm really interested in that. But what I tend to do is if something interests me, I will grab the object, knowing that the thing is infused with that story and with that, with the emotion that it prompts in me. So every time I look at that thing, I will feel this, I will feel something, something will be sparked. And if it keeps sparking me, I know it's important, and eventually it will come up, you know, so that I have very few files for this book, oddly.
I'm astonished.
I know. I have boxes full of manuscript drafts because there were 22 drafts, but I have very few clipping files, physical files, anything like that. But I do have, you know, my aunt's scrapbooks. I have photographs. I have, you know, I was fascinated with Norman Bethune. So I read deeply into tuberculosis. My family always summered up in Muskoka, where in Gravenhurst, where the Bethune tuberculosis sanatorium was. So this book.
Did you make notes?
No. No, but I have a perfect memory. I have a really, really good memory of, and I'm, it's, this is not something I've cultivated. I believe it's something one is born with, and I'm incredibly grateful for it. But this book feels like a gathering in of a lifetime's collection of small detail.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me take something directly out of the acknowledgments and ask you about it. My good friend Ellen Stafford planted the seed for this novel, and I'm interested in what that seed was and how she planted it, and maybe who she is. We should probably
yes, you should
give
start
her.
With that, Ellen. So Ellen Stafford, which was not her real name; it was an invented name, and that's partly explains the sort of obsession with naming that runs through the book. Ellen was one of my elder female friends. She was in her 90s when I knew her. She published her first book when she was 80. And
let that be a beacon of hope for all of you listening who are approaching.
Absolutely. She was Pierre Burton's first editor. Oh. She was brilliant. A vast reader, and we had magnificent literary conversations. She lived every winter in Mexico, hence people will notice in the book that the sort of migratory nature between Canada and Mexico started with my relationship with Ellen. Ellen died quite quickly. Within 3 days, she fell ill. Got pneumonia and died. She was only in the hospital for 3 days. She was a very healthy woman. And I went to see her in the hospital, and she was hallucinating. I don't know if it was from the pneumonia or from drugs or from entering that dying space. But she thought they were making a movie in her hospital room. And when I came in to visit, she said, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here. They're making a movie of the book you're writing. You know, the book about love, death, and the whole damn thing."
And?
Well, I guess I had to write it, didn't I?
She put you on the spot. So, and there's a movie yet to be made. So that was it.
That was it. And so I actually dedicate the book to her with the quote, "Love, death, and the whole damn thing." Yeah, I started thinking about it then. She had a couple of manuscripts that hadn't been published yet, and her daughter, Laurie Lewis, who's also a writer and also a friend, gave those manuscripts to me. And I thought a lot about that migratory principle, that, you know, what is it that drives us to leave the place that we were born and go to somewhere else? And what's the difference between the people who choose to do that and the people who are forced to do that? And what is the reception like at the other end? And how does that differ between those two kinds of people? And so, and I've spent my whole life has been quite peripatetic. And I, you know, born in Winnipeg, grew up in South America, have spent time all over. And now I too am migrating between Mexico and Canada. And so all of those thoughts sort of were part of the gestation period.
Tell me why, what it is, that's a better way to ask this question, what it is about Cass, another older woman, I think close to 100.
96, right.
96. What it is about her that took hold of you and wouldn't let go?
That's a really hard question. I think it's in the voice. You know, it's the same as with The Convict Lover. The thing that drove me through that book in the 8 years of writing that book was the voice of the man who wrote the letters, you know, the prisoner in Kingston Penitentiary who wrote the letters to that young woman. And in the same way, it was this voice of this older woman that was crusty and indomitable and so authentic in a way that most of us don't get to through our youth and our middle years, but that I often hear in old women. Just strength, but strength without privilege, without a sense of self-righteousness or pretension. And I think the whole process of the book was an attempt to get to the source, almost like water, getting to the wellspring of that voice. How does that voice happen?
And underneath that voice, the crustiness, as you call it, the toughness, the indomitable. And I love the way Cass frequently is self-referential about her own obnoxiousness.
she knows she's obnoxious.
That's right. And goes ahead anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm
like this because I can get away with it.
That's right. I'm old now. Nobody can call me on it. But underneath that is, and I hope this is not giving anything away, and I suppose we can deal with that in the editing room if it does give too much away. But underneath that is a choice, really, that Cass has to make regarding her son. And whether to protect him by sending him away to live with his aunt, and first of all in the summers, and then more, and the choice that she has to make about sending him away, and to ostensibly protect him. I mean, or mm-hmm. not even ostensibly. I mean, it's real. Mm-hmm. This is a tough time medically and everything else, and it's just going to be safer for him not to be in New York City. And yet also the lingering feeling that she has that was a mistake or could be a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that perhaps her motives were selfish, mm-hmm. Not just entirely around him,
mm-hmm.
and that struggle is just there throughout. Well, she comes to it later. She comes to realize
mm-hmm.
that maybe it was a choice.
Well, I've found that really interesting, and I find it interesting in my own life. This, as your life proceeds, you know, life is just a series of decisions, and yet that tendency in all of us to recast our decisions in such a way to make sense of our life. We do that, right? We actually, you know, I think our lives are closer to a series of linked short stories than they are to a novel. And as each circumstance rises, we, in our memory, we recast the ones that went before it to provide shape to our life and meaning. But I think we reach a certain point where, in looking back, we're inclined to be more critical. And we don't, maybe we lose the need to see the pattern. I'm not sure. Maybe we lose the need to self-justify. But then we start looking at our decisions a little more honestly. And I think that's where Cass is. And I'm very interested in that process where we're able to see the complexity of our own motivation.
Which completely fascinates me and has been a preoccupation of mine recently, because I used to read literature, think about my own life in terms of sort of single motives. This I did this because of this,
I'm this kind of person
because of. And then realizing that any particular action and any really significant action often has a whole mixture of motives. Some of it is a little bit selfish, but that doesn't mean that it also wasn't selfless. And it doesn't mean, I mean...
It doesn't mean it was the wrong decision.
And it doesn't mean it was the wrong...
And your decision changes, you know? I mean, the challenge for Cass was... You know, she knew what those epidemics were like.
Sorry, we
got
in the
30s.
Right, have context here, because I don't think we've talked about.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, Cass is a nurse. That's not giving too much away, is it? In the 30s, before inoculation, and there were pandemics of childhood diseases that washed through, especially cities, especially crowded areas of cities, poor areas where she lived with her son. And, you know, killed thousands and maimed for life many hundreds of thousands more. And among those were things like diphtheria. But polio was, infantile paralysis, was one of the worst through the 30s. And she sent him away to the farm, her sister's farm, so that he would not be there in the summer months when this virus incubated. And the relationship with her sister and with her home place, her birth home, is very problematic and becomes more problematic. And that sets off a whole, it triggers a whole series of events that becomes the central sort of torture in her life. And so she goes back to that, you know, in her mind, to that instigating moment and wonders, mm-hmm. you know, and of course things would have turned out differently if you'd made a different decision, but you make the decisions you make.
And then you gotta live with that.
Yeah.
We've talked a bit about structure, and I wanted to move into that now. And I'm going to start with a specific example from the book. But before I do that, I just want to tell a bit of a story that when I was reading Michael Chabon's novel about Oakland, I think it's called Telegraph Avenue, it took me a while to figure out what he was doing. And what he was doing in many instances as he started a scene was he would start with a close-up. And And the usual narrative approach to things is to start with that wide angle shot, setting the context, and this is where they are, and then you move in, and then you get closer and closer, and then all of a sudden they're talking to each other. He plunks you into the middle of a conversation between these people, and you're kind of going, who the hell are, what, where are we, what's happening here? And then he pulls back, and he pulls back, and he pulls back, and he ends with that wide shot. And once you get used to that as a kind of a rhythm, you go, okay, I get it. I see what's happening here. He's just changed the convention of storytelling. The specific example that I would bring out of your novel is a chapter or a section that begins with the son, Cass's son, and a silver box, and then it moves, and it's maybe three sentences or something like that, and you don't know exactly where did this box come from, what's the significance. Then there's another paragraph that takes you back in time, gives you a little more of the story about that box, and then you go back and tell the whole history, and that happens a number of times. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in how you arrived at that, and as a narrative style and structure, and what?
Well, it was a torture developing the structure of this book and getting it right. I mean, I hope I get it more or less right. Once I realized that there was a present day narrative, and she and the interstitial pieces would be her memory that was triggered by what was going on in the present. Then I did a lot of research into how memory works, and a lot of self-analysis as to how my memory works. And I think, I hope the structure reflects the memory process, which is something triggers a flash. Right. And we have that flash. And then that little flash scene or thought or smell or whatever, it triggers another one. And usually in my mind anyway, it triggers kind of a blossom of things. Right. And so you go off in these different directions.
You go from something very specific like an ant to an ant hill to
an ant hill in Brazil, and then one in South America, and then one in, you know, another place. And then yeah, and then your mind tunnels deeper and wider. So it is a widening process, and the mind jumps from trigger to trigger. It's the mind is not chronological. I think, you know, chronology, time, those are shaping devices that we as humans put on things, but our raw mind inside is jumping.
Chaotic.
It's chaotic. It's jumping all over the place. So that's what I tried to develop. And my worry was, you know, would the reader be able to follow those leaps? And
I was going to say, you knew you were taking a risk here.
Oh, it's huge risk. But what I decided was, if I could set up the first one well enough, it's exactly what you said. Because myself as a reader, if I can figure out the structure up front, I'm with you, right? I can, you know, I know it's going to continue and I'm comfortable. And that first one will likely make readers uncomfortable. But I think then after that, every time they hit one of these memory bits, which are flagged visually in the book by an icon, by a change in icon, the present day story has one icon and the memory stories have another icon. So whenever you see the beetle, you know you're going to beetle back into the brain in some weird way. I think people get used to it. And I know that's true because I was very worried about this structure. It was my biggest worry with this book. Because once you've read the book once, you can no longer be critical as to whether it's working because you get the system. So even my editor and definitely myself, I did not feel capable of judging whether my refinements were refinements or further confusions. So for this book,
you needed test readers.
Unlike any other book, I got 10 beta readers, what are called beta readers. And it's not that they are second class, it's that the manuscript is next to last. It's beta, not alpha. So I found 10 beta readers with various kinds of expertise. So I found a 97-year-old woman and a couple of millennials and a playwright and a Métis woman and somebody
who... representative sample, yeah. Demographically.
That's right. And a woman, a couple who'd lived in Burma all their lives and been teachers. And so this, and a geriatric nurse and like all these various people, right? Who read the manuscript. And one of the key things I was looking for was, I said, mark when you get confused and mark when you emerge from the confusion. And so that way I was able to do the final test of the structure. And I think I made 3 sort of tweaks at that stage. That was the last stage before the manuscript went to press. And it was hugely useful. Huge. I can't tell you how useful, because this, it is strange. It is a very strange structure. And the others, I don't know if we're going to talk about voice, but voice is related to this because...
We can talk about voice okay. if you want.
I do, because I found it so fascinating that in my research around memory, it turns out that men and women, their memories play back in a different way. This is generalizing, but nevertheless, I'm not afraid to generalize. So women, men in their memories, they tend to be first person. So with men, they are actors in their memories. So whereas women tend to be observers in their memories. So their memories play out there and they themselves are a character in their memories, but it's not first person, it's third person. And then, and this is especially true for women who've been traumatized, abused, suffered any kind of abuse.
It's almost a disassociation.
It is. Well, it's certainly a distancing at the very best and a disassociation at its,
yeah,
more,
that's
at its more extreme.
But that's happening over there,
that's right,
to somebody else, really not
that's right,
really me.
But what is really, really interesting to me is that as women age and as they emerge from trauma, their memories become first person. So... In the novel, the memory sections, the Beatles sections, are in the third person. And that reflects the way a woman remembers, especially trauma. But after she is able to face the traumatizing parts of her life, then in the fourth section of the book, the last section, you'll notice it is told entirely in the first person. And it's also told in the first person continuous present. So the past and the present become one continuous present time. There's no longer any separation between the past and the present. So this is a point of view I have never seen anywhere in literature. I'm sure it exists, but I haven't come across it. And it was... That was the second hugely risk-taking part of this book for me.
Let me make a comment on the first part, which is that we were talking about, and the structure and your beta readers and so on. And the observation is that I think certainly for me, and I would imagine for many readers, there's a certain satisfaction and pleasure that comes from figuring something out.
Right.
You know,
right.
When you're presented with a challenge and I think we're like rats in a maze sometimes, and we just go, what's going on here? And you figure it out. And then you feel really good about yourself.
As long as you don't give up.
As long as you don't give up. When you talk about memory and changing the person, from third to first and into the final section and so on. Do you care whether anybody notices that?
Oh, no, not at all. No, in fact, I would be happier if they didn't. And as I was saying, I thought, oh, shoot, I shouldn't say this because it's going to make people look for it. No, this is, how do I explain this? I don't care if they notice. I think it is implicit to how well the story works. I had to do it in order to make the story, drive properly. You know, it was part of the internal gear structure. And in the same way that we don't see the gears in the vehicle that we're riding in, and we don't really care, at least I don't care to know how it works, we do want the ride to be smooth and to be, appropriate. And so these are things I felt I had to do to make the form completely embedded in the content. And that's always been important to me. Form to me doesn't exist for form's sake. Form to me has to arise out of the content and has to be perfectly aligned with it. It has to be a seamless organic whole. And so the extraordinary amount of time it took me to develop this refine it was all challenging but immensely satisfying, because I felt at the end that her story was reflected and told in a way that was exactly attuned to what it was about.
I'm glad you brought up the changing gears and the gear analogy, because it allows me to just change gears whenever the hell I want.
That's right.
Just, okay, I'm going into third now, as long as I don't go into reverse. You pay homage to writers, and you mentioned it already way back at the beginning of this conversation, John Dos Passos and Gabriel Roy, Carlos Fuentes. There are a number of writers. And I'm interested in how you were drawn to those specific kind of writers, and then how they made their way, or their voice, or their perspective, or something about them made their way into the book.
Yeah. Well, John Dos Passos arrived because Cass moves to New York City from Mexico City in 1929. And for me, I mean, I've been to New York City, not often, but I was there as a child. And so my responses to New York City are very kind of visceral, not very intellectual. And when I think Manhattan, I think John Dos Passos and his novel, Manhattan. And I went back and I reread that. And it was the rhythms of his voice that felt like the city to me. And I know that that's my 10-year-old self talking. And so one of the things he does is he does not use hyphens. So when he says lighthearted or clippity-clop or jam junkie, those words are compressed together because he doesn't want even the smallest pause. He uses, of almost any writer I've ever read, he uses punctuation like musical notation, and he forces you to breathe in certain ways to propel the prose, the music of the prose. And I've always been very interested in cadence and music in the prose. So you will notice in in the New York sections of the novel, I didn't leave the hyphens out because I thought that might be, too much borrowing. So that the hyphens are there, but there are a lot of hyphenated words, and the rhythm is particularly important in those sections. And similarly, when Cass moves back to Canada and to Montreal, when I think of Montreal in the 50s, well, it's Gabriel Roy country, right? So the Tin Flute, I mean, that was, I don't remember what year in the 50s that was published, but it's about the Montreal in the 50s. And so You know, I have cast living in Griffintown, which coincidentally is where my ancestors on one of my ancestors on my father's side ran a boarding house in the late 19th century. So I have an affection for Griffintown and Saint-Henri. And so I read the tin flute many times. And again, it was the cadences. It's mostly in the cadences of the description that it comes through. It's not in the content in any way. It's very much about music.
That is interesting to me because we share an affection for John Dos Passos, and I realize that we're like two stamp collectors marveling over a 1837 imprint.
How
from,
did you know I collected stamps?
Well, you're a magpie. But for people who, because Dos Passos and Hemingway were pals, had a falling out. They were comparable novelists at one point, essentially, and maybe even Dos Passos was more critically acclaimed, although not necessarily as popular or sold as well as Hemingway. But for people who don't know, Dos Passos was a social realist fiction writer of that era, most famous for a trilogy, 1919, yep. 49th Parallel and The Big Money.
Yep.
So it's actually the content that I remember more because right. he wrote about people,
yes.
And he wrote about big institutions and rich people, yep. And somehow crammed yep. them all into the same.
Well,
novels.
and that's an interesting point because I, as well as the cadences, I do think that both Gaboriau and Dos Passos are talking about people in, you know, living in what some people would characterize as the lower echelons of society. And that's where Cass is living as well. And so, you know, I have no doubt that was also an influence on the story.
I could talk to you forever.
Likewise.
And there's so much in the book, but I think we should leave a little bit for people to discover on their own by reading the book, which is ultimately the goal of this whole exercise, get people excited and interested in looking for the book. So I'm gonna ease us into a conclusion, and I'm interested in how, and I realize that an author is not always in charge of or the marketing or positioning of their book, but I noticed that the way it's being described on the jacket and so on by the publisher and so on talks about refuge and who do we offer refuge to and those kinds of issues. And it's certainly a big part of the book with our Burmese stateless, homeless kind of refugee coming into Cass's life. But I just can't shake the fact that for me, this book is about family relationships. It's about father and daughter. So we haven't talked about Cass's father at all, this marvelous, curious man who looks at everything around him in terms of scientific inquiry. How do we understand the world around mm-hmm. us? May, Cass's sister, who, and that leads us into a whole rumination about birth order and roles within families. And so there's the sister relationship. There's obviously the mother-son relationship between Cass and so on. So for me, it's a book about family relationships.
It's both things, I think.
And of course, it doesn't have to be just one thing.
One or the other. And I guess for me, where they come together is that family is often characterized as the safe place, the sanctuary in all of our lives, right? And for me, what in her story, the questions that came up are, you know, is family the sanctuary? And what do we owe our family relationships? And is blood thicker than water? Is that where we come home to? Does home reside in the family?
And are our obligations primarily to family, or are our obligations to the wider humanity?
It was that question exactly that on which turns the notion of sanctuary for Nang. You know, will Cass give her sanctuary because of the blood connection? Does she believe that blood connection? Or would she give her sanctuary no matter what? Should she give her sanctuary no matter what? What is our relationship to the wider world and our responsibility to the wider world? So that, you know, that sort of, not conflict exactly, but the push and pull between the global and the local and the family and the society. I think that those two things are equal, that the family relationship on the one hand is so complex. In order to create a balance for the larger issue of how we function within society.
Well, I hope that there's a section on the website. You have a marvelous website. If you're listening to this, you might be at the website.
Maybe
now
not.
That I'm thinking about this. But I hope that this conversation, wider conversation now with readers who bring their own, because we know that no book is read the same way twice, even by the same person. You know, you read it 10 years later and it's a different book and you're a different person and so on.
And I love that. I love that conversation. I always find things in my books from talking to readers that I didn't even know were there. You know, sort of, I remember going to a book club once and the person presenting the book presented a whole thing on fire imagery in the lion in the room next door. And I thought, what? Really? And she was absolutely right. There's all this fire. I mean, everything's bursting into flames all over the place. And I was shocked. I didn't realize I was doing that. You know, so I love those conversations with readers. And one of the things I've done with this book is there's a special section of the website just for refuge. And I'm putting up stories behind the story, sort of talking about the various elements and how I became aware of them and how they wove into the story for me, you know, wove through fact and into my imagination and then out into the story.
You know, I shouldn't do this, but I can't resist telling just a quick story about doing an event with the great and venerable Canadian novelist Audrey Thomas, novelist, short story writer, in Vancouver. And she told a story and she said, that a graduate student somewhere got in touch with her and said, I would like to do a thesis or do some work on your work. Is that okay? And Audrey kind of humped and said, well, you know, if you must, I'm a little tired of all that. But anyway, so they started a connection and the graduate student was sending Audrey questions. And one of her questions, and this is very much paraphrased, was, what is it about you and hands? And Audrey said, what are you talking about? And the graduate student just went through books and books and books that Audrey had written and hands.
Hands.
Yeah. And then Audrey said, and you know what I'm thinking about my next work? Is about somebody who undergoes a hand transplant. And it was like,
woo, 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 woo.
But there is, yes, there's stuff going on. I didn't want to end with a story about somebody else. I wanted to, so we will end with you. And I hope that conversation that you're talking about with your readers takes place, because I can imagine how fascinating it will be for you to encounter those observations mm-hmm. and reactions that you as yet can't really imagine.
No, I've had a few early comments from booksellers, and the things that really, really make me happy is that they find Cass McCallum an unforgettable character. And that's what she was for me. That's why we hung on for 14 years together until her story got told the way she wanted it told.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.